This week on The Book Review, two very different international communities. First, what's life like in the world's biggest refugee camp? Ben Rollins will be here to talk about his new book, City of Thorns.
The UN doesn't give out tea, doesn't give out soap, doesn't give out sugar. So if you want those things, you have to go hungry for a day or two. The price of anything, basically, in the camp is hunger.
And what's life like for wealthy expat American women in Hong Kong? Janice Y.K. Lee will be here to talk about her new novel, The Expatriates.
We were all connected by this fact that we had help and we had time. Imagine if you didn't have to do the laundry or, you know, make the beds or clean the house. You would have a lot more time.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Ben Rollins is here now to talk about his new book, City of Thorns, Nine Lives in the World's Largest Refugee Camp. Ben, hi, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
This is a portrait of nine people who live in the largest refugee camp, which is located where?
In Kenya, about 70 miles from the border with Somalia. And the camp is mostly home to people from Somalia who have fled the civil war there that's been going on for nearly 25 years now.
So when was the camp founded?
In 1991, about 90,000 people initially were housed in three camps of small towns of about 30,000 each. Now, 25 years later, the population is pushing 500,000, and we've got five camps spread over an area of around 30 square miles. It's about the same size as metropolitan New Orleans.
And all of these together are called Dadaab?
Dadaab. It's the Dadaab complex. Each camp itself has an individual name. So each of these small cities of 100,000 people has its own name, its own market, its own council, its own football teams, and, you know, everything that you'd expect a city has, except it's a temporary slum and it's made of sticks and mud and plastic and people can't leave.
Have the camps, in addition to the size, changed over time over this period of 25 years?
Yes, they've become increasingly permanent. Initially, people are issued with tents, but after a few years, those degrade in the weather, and people usually build their own huts out of a frame of thorns, and then they cover that with mud and with grass. Of course, there are sort of illegal additions to the camps, because as the camps became more and more overcrowded, people built their own suburbs, which the UN later had to incorporate and had to somehow regularize. So they're in flux kind of all the time.
In terms of who's coming to those camps over the 25 years, has that changed?
The majority of the people living in the camp are Somalis. The current population is a mixture of people whose parents came or even whose grandparents came. We're on to our third generation now living in the camp. And then other people have arrived from Somalia as there have been successive waves of conflict in Somalia. And there are also some Ethiopians, a few people from Congo, from Rwanda, even from the genocide in 94, a lot of Sudanese. It's quite a cosmopolitan melting pot. And of course, there are tensions associated with that.
And so how do people get to this camp? And do people say, you know, when people are fleeing, do they specifically try to get to this camp as opposed to...
Well, there are two big camps in Kenya. Mm-hmm. There are also some camps in Ethiopia. The main character in the book, a young guy called Guled, comes here rather than anywhere else because that's the one he's heard of the most. And also he knows that there's a friend of his who lives there. So that's the place in his imagination that he can reach.
And you said that there are now three generations of some families living here. What happens to people who are born in this camp? What is their citizenship? Can they leave? How does that work?
Several characters in the book have children during the period that I was researching. And what happens is they're given a birth certificate, which is from the Kenyan government, but it's stamped with a big red mark, which says refugee. So they are, in effect, stateless. No country wants to resettle stateless people, so they're pretty much stuck. They will, unless something happens, probably spend their whole lives there.
There's no growing up and leaving home.
No. Firstly, people are living in very small compounds. It's very hard to get additional space. So as the families grow, the compounds get subdivided. So what you find now is where once there may have been a kind of wide open space where people kept goats or they hung washing, now has been chopped up into six or seven different sub-compounds, and people are marrying and having their own families in smaller and smaller spaces.
How is all of this governed? I mean, who's in charge of a refugee camp like this?
Dadaab is run by the UN, but there are elections, some of the cleanest elections in Africa, for representatives of the refugees who then negotiate with the UN about how services are run. So, for example, we have Tawane, one of the young guys featured in the book, who was elected as a youth leader of all of the camps. When the UN had to stop services because some of the aid workers were kidnapped, he had to mobilize volunteers to come and run all the services in the absence of the UN. Officially, the UN has to provide all these services, but there is a role for the refugees as well.
And you first came into contact with these camps and your former job as working for Human Rights Watch. What is it that you were doing with Human Rights Watch at these camps?
I worked for Human Rights Watch for about nearly 10 years as a researcher on Africa. I was looking at human rights abuses in Ethiopia and in Somalia, and the camps are the perfect place to find testimony about those issues because they are full of people who have suffered and who have fled. So we used to go to the camps regularly to interview new arrivals with fresh information about the war in Somalia. What struck me about the place was, A, that it existed, that this crazy kind of limbo city could exist. And secondly, was not just the sad stories that I was collecting professionally, but the day-to-day stories, the kind of things that are in the book that people always ask me about Dadaab is, well, how does it work?
Right.
How do they eat? What do they do for fun? What do they, you know, how do they get any money? There are no banks, so, you know, people bury their cash in the ground. It was these.
And where is that money from? I mean, what state?
Yes, and if you want money in Dadaab and you can't work, the only thing you can do is you collect your food rations and then you sell some.
So it's a kind of barter system?
So you can barter food for other things. Like the UN doesn't give out tea, doesn't give out soap, doesn't give out sugar. So if you want those things, you have to go hungry for a day or two. Some people go hungry for 2 or 3 years to save up the capital so they can start a business so that they can improve their lives. But the price of anything basically in the camp is hunger.
But you've mentioned that people are coming from Ethiopia, they're coming from Somalia. I imagine there's all different tribes, there are different religions. Is there conflict within the camp?
There is. And one of the main stories in the book is between a young Somali woman called Muna and a young lost boy from Sudan called Monday, who fall in love. And of course, in Somalia, they would never have met. Muna would never have met this guy. But here in the camp, in this melting pot, they have a relationship. They have a child. And Muna's family waged this campaign to try and kidnap the infant and sacrifice it, basically, because they think it's a mutant. It's a child of this poisonous union between a Christian and a Muslim. So there's a big drama about them trying to escape the camp and to be safe. And at one point, the lost boys have to protect the baby with spears. And, you know, these kind of day-to-day family tensions are what, to me, is fascinating, how life continues in this place. Not only the bigger political questions, but really that sort of daily life stuff.
So you came to the camp as a researcher for Human Rights Watch. When did you decide and how did you decide to write a book about it?
I went back to my notes recently, actually, and I wrote in my journal and at the time in 2010, wow, somebody should write a book about this place because it just should not exist. Quite quickly, I went back under my own steam to do some initial research. And then I asked for a sabbatical from Human Rights Watch. That ended up turning into leaving Human Rights Watch. I got a fellowship from the Open Society Foundation to do more research because I realized I needed to spend a lot of time there. And research in the camp is very expensive because you need bodyguards, you have to fly there, you got to pay translators and so on. It became a labor of love, as these things do, over the last sort of 4 or 5 years.
Now, how does that work when you go and you're researching the camp and you're there? You're not staying in the camp.
Well, I'm staying in the UN compound, which is surrounded by blast walls and barbed wire. And that is situated in Dadaab town, which is in the middle of these 5 camps. The camps kind of orbit the town like moons.
And did that town itself exist before these camps existed?
It did, but it was very small. So it was a tiny colonial outpost established by the British with a borehole. But since the early 90s, it's exploded. And lots of people have come there seeking work because the agencies are spending money. They're constructing stuff.
So these camps have kind of become a business for this tiny little town.
It's the biggest urban conurbation between Nairobi and Mogadishu. It's the largest city for thousands of miles around. And it's, in fact, the largest economy in the region.
What was it like before 1991?
It was pretty sparse grazing area, desert in the dry season. And after the rains, there would have been a light covering of grass, which the Somali nomads would have grazed with their camels. And in fact, Tawane's family in the book, they were grazing their camels on that land. His grandparents were grazing camels on that land not that long ago. But in the 60s, the British gave that area to Kenya instead of Somalia.
And gave, these, in quotes. It,
well, exactly, yes. Now that part of Kenya, there are people who are refugees, in fact, once upon a time considered it their land. It's just one of the contradictions of the colonial legacy and which shape how people live now.
So you can go to that town in the middle of these five large refugee compounds and stay in a hotel?
There is a hotel in the town. It's probably safe enough, but the UN wants all foreign visitors, especially ones, white ones like me, to be in the compound and to be protected all the time, because if a foreigner gets kidnapped, it upsets their operations. They have to suspend all the services right. that help the refugees. So the biggest disservice I could do to the refugees would have been to get kidnapped. So I had to look after myself.
Did you feel safe in the camps?
I did, always. I've always felt safe in the camps. I think a lot of our idea of fear comes from what we're told by other people, and actually it's not always based on personal experience. I think the camp suffers from a lot of bad press, to be honest. Yes, there have been kidnaps, but there have been kidnaps in Nairobi, in Bogota, and other places. And by and large, it's very peaceful. Everybody has been living there for many years. They all know each other. People leave their doors unlocked. I mean, it's a pretty relaxed atmosphere.
So you first went in there for Human Rights Watch, doing interviews, research for a very specific purpose. You then come back there as a writer, writing a book about the place. How did that change your interactions with people? Were they more willing to talk to you, less willing?
I never had a problem with people not wanting to talk to me when I was for Human Rights Watch or even now. I find the Somalis in general, but the refugees in the camp, very willing to talk because I think nobody shows them much interest. They're very happy to tell the story of their lives. I found working in the UK, in fact, harder, where people are much more reticent to open up. The relationship between the two modes of working was actually a creative tension, because what I did for Human Rights Watch was this kind of forensic reporting where you try and build up a picture of a crime scene that might mm-hmm. stand up in an international court. So I applied that forensic methodology to people's daily lives.
Right. You're not also trying to draw them out in the same kind of way. It's a sort of you're trying to get data.
Yes. Yeah. You're just trying to get descriptions. And then also you're sitting down having tea and asking them how they're feeling, and you're becoming friends, and now we're still friends. I mean, today, those books that I sent to everybody have arrived, and they've all received their book, and they're, they let me know that they've got it. So it's an ongoing relationship.
The book is organized around these nine portraits. So this is a huge refugee camp, 300,000 people. How did you come to these nine particular stories?
I started with quite a broad net with about 50 people. Mm-hmm. I had previously for Human Rights Watch interviewed hundreds of people. So I had a sense of the issues and the populations and so on. And that 50 over the first kind of 6 months, I narrowed down to about 16. And then the last year we were down to 12. And then finally the nine stories that made it into the book are the ones that are left.
Did you think to yourself, I want to get someone who represents this kind of story or this issue, and I want someone else who comes from this perspective?
I did try and get a balance of experiences, and that was certainly in my mind at the beginning. In the end, the way it turned out was really just those relationships that stood the test of time. Because in one case, one woman went back to Somalia. Another one didn't want me, in the end, to write her story. Some people's family dramas played out in interesting ways, and some people's nothing happened. So, their story became less, had less relevance, perhaps, in the long run. When you're following people over 3 or 4 years, it was probably just an organic evolution, really, of how our friendship moved.
So you use the word friendship again, and it's interesting because you weren't here as a journalist, where you have all these tricky ethical lines of, you know, you as a journalist, you can't pay someone for their story, but you don't necessarily have that. But I imagine that there were lines that you were comfortable crossing and not crossing. What was that like? I mean, you mentioned having tea with someone. These are people who most of them don't have any money, right? So you're...
Yeah. Well, I felt very conscious of that all the time. And while I was researching the book and getting the information, I was very clear that, you know, yes, we're friends, but you're telling me your story. And I was very clear to play down expectations that, you know, I can't help you and that I can't get you out of the camp as much as I would love to. At the end of the book, in the epilogue, I talk about the coming to the end of the research process and then trying to see how I can help people. Mm-hmm. And I was able to then effect some change for some people because they had cases pending with the UN. So, for example, the Muna and Monday, who had been waiting for an emergency case of resettlement that hadn't happened, after my digging, we realized that it had stalled and actually the file had been lost. And the Australian embassy suddenly leapt into life and now she's in Australia, living a new life, I hope. I also describe talking to the refugees, reading them the stories that I had written about their lives. And finally, buying them lunch. And, well, I always used to buy them lunch, but, you know, buying them a lunch and talking about how I can help them now. And, in some cases, I have tried to assist them now that that work's done. And, you know, hopefully if the book does well, there might be other ways in which they can be assisted or other people might want to come and help.
It must be hard to end a book like this when you have become so involved in their lives.
It is. I was just saying to my friend, I never cried during the research process, despite all these very heartbreaking stories. But I did cry 2 weeks ago when I had to dedicate each copy of the book to each of the people who were mentioned in it. And what do you say? How do you say thank you for sharing your story? And I really hope that the future holds good things. But I know that that's very unlikely, that actually they may well still be stuck there. So that for me was actually the most heartbreaking moment.
Well, it's a book with a lot of emotion in it. The title again is City of Thorns, 9 Lives in the World's Largest Refugee Camp by Ben Rollins. Ben, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with news from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So this week we get to talk about movies, too?
Yes, we're expanding the whole podcast. It's going to be movies and books. No, I'm just kidding. So yesterday, on Thursday, the Oscar nominations were announced, and it's a huge year for book adaptations. 5 of the 8 Oscar nominees for Best Picture are book adaptations, and 4 of those are based on novels, which is even more unusual. In a more typical year, there's just a couple of adaptations usually up for Oscars, and they're often the kind of based on a true story type movies rather than adaptations of literary fiction. And the strong showing for book adaptations carried over into other categories like Best Actor and Actress, where nominations went to The Danish Girl, which is based on a novel by David Ebershoff, and Carol, which is based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. And the really encouraging thing, apart from the fact that these movies got made in the first place and are getting recognition, is the kinds of books that are getting made into
good
into
books.
Great books, actually. So as people probably saw, among the nominations are Brooklyn by Colm Tóibín, The Big Short by Michael Lewis, Room by Emma Donoghue, which is a really sort of chilling novel and a hard one to adapt, and The Martian by Andy Weir, and The Revenant, which is based on Michael Punke's 2002 novel about a frontiersman that actually picked up 12 nominations.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to part ways with you on The Martian, but you liked that, didn't you?
I loved it.
You did. I couldn't get
through
it.
And I love the book. There's so much crazy
science
in it. No,
I love the movie. Let me say,
oh, okay.
I hated the book.
Oh, okay. I think the book is a little bit polarizing. But if you want to learn how many potatoes you need to survive for 3 years, it's a good book to read. In any case, I think, you know, this is going to be really encouraging for publishers who have been complaining for the last few years that Hollywood had forgotten all about them. They were focused on these big kind of comic book franchises. And if they did make movies based on books, it was always the big fantasy series like The Hunger Games books that obviously that helps sales, but they don't really need the recognition the way these little literary novels do. And for a while, it seemed like, you know, novelists had also given up on Hollywood. And they were all going to HBO and occasionally to streaming services to get their adaptations made. So this could signal Hollywood's reignited interest in literary novels as source material.
I feel like there's, you know, all movie people secretly want to write books, and all book people secretly want to have their books made into
movies. Absolutely, yeah.
Or maybe not so secretly.
No, there's a lot of exchange happening now. You're seeing screenwriters writing novels and novelists writing screenplays, of course.
Is this the most number of adaptations among the Best Picture nominees?
That's a good question. It's only been a few years since they expanded the nominations.
So it's a cheaty question.
Yeah, a little bit. But I would imagine, I mean, it's almost all of them. You know, it's such a high number. And it'll be, I think it'll be great for the authors and for publishers. The tie-in editions are out, selling well. So,
well, I won't ask you to do predictions, but I will ask about your preferences. Which do you think was the best book of those movies, and which was the best movie of those books?
That's an excellent question. So, first of all, I haven't seen them all or even read them all, but I've read The Martian, Room, The Big Short. And of those, they're so different. I mean, I think maybe The Big Short. I just learned so much. That's
Michael. More than just about potatoes?
Yeah, that's Michael Lewis's book, which was adapted by Adam McKay, and who also directed it. And it was really a strange kind of film. It's got this kind of almost madcap quality. I loved it, too. But it's, you learn a lot about these complex financial instruments that caused the 2008 crisis.
Well, that's what we go to the movies for.
That's what I always go to for. And then I recently watched Brooklyn and loved that movie, but haven't read the book. So now I feel like I need to read the book. It's such a beautiful, quiet story. And again, an unusual choice to adapt. It's really just about one person, this woman from Ireland, who goes to Brooklyn in the 1950s. And it's, you know, not a ton happens, but it's absolutely riveting. So I imagine the book must be similar.
Now that I've caught you reading it so much again, I want to follow up on a question that came to me after our last podcast. And that question was for you, which is, Alexander Alter, how do you read so much? Where do you find the time? Tell us your secret.
My secret is that I have a lot of net galleys, which means I have my books all on my phone and on my Kindle, and I have a terrible commute to work that can take me occasionally an hour or more. So I do that twice a day, and I'm reading the whole time, and then I end up reading at night in the dark a lot. That's basically the secret, is just to, anytime you have a spare moment, grab your phone or Kindle, or if you're carrying around a paper copy, read it. But I have so many to get through, I often have them in ebook form.
I could tell you were reluctant to reveal the truth.
Anyway, back to Hollywood. It looks like there's going to be another wave of adaptations for 2016, which is exciting. Some of the ones I'm really looking forward to are Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is being adapted by Ang Lee, and that's another book that I loved, as well as The Girl on the Train, which is based on the hugely best-selling novel by Paula Hawkins. So I think there'll be a few more coming in the pipeline in 2016.
More books as movies to look forward to. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Janice Y.K. Lee joins us now to talk about her new novel, The Expatriates. Hi, Janice.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So this is a novel that takes place in Hong Kong, where you lived until recently. How long were you in Hong Kong?
I moved in 2005, and I lived there for 10 years.
10 years and two novels.
Yes. I started my novel in New York, and then I finished it to a novel and a half.
The first one, The Piano Teacher.
Right.
What's The Expatriates about?
It's about three very different American women who find themselves in Hong Kong, and they're living all sorts of very different lives, but the expat community is so small that they intersect and they affect each other in ways that you come to see in the book.
Your first novel, also set in Hong Kong, was more of a historical novel. Did you know when you got there, I want to write about these people now, about this situation in Hong Kong now?
No. So I had started The Piano Teacher when I lived in New York, and then I finished it when I was in Hong Kong. I started looking for what I was going to write next, and then it ended up that, you know, I don't have a plot or an outline when I start my books. I just start from a character or an image. And I had this woman, and the woman started the book, and I didn't know where she lived or what she did or anything about her. And as she started to be revealed to me, it was apparent that she lived in Hong Kong, in the Hong Kong that I lived in. And
very convenient.
I know. Well, actually, I sort of didn't want that to be the case because I didn't want to write two novels in Hong Kong. I thought, oh, I can go somewhere else. But I actually couldn't.
But your first novel was also set in Hong Kong, and you began it in New York. You didn't move to Hong Kong to finish the novel set in Hong Kong.
No. That was serendipitous. I moved to Hong Kong because my husband got transferred there. I think that was based on my childhood because I was born and raised in Hong Kong. I'm a Korean that was born and raised in Hong Kong. And when I was in graduate school here at Hunter College, I started a short story about a little girl who was living in Hong Kong. And that formed the basis of what would become The Piano Teacher. And then it just happened that in the middle of that, I moved to Hong Kong, which was great because then I could access all the very esoteric research materials that I needed to do that novel.
And I would imagine that Hong Kong then, when you lived in it as a child, is very different from Hong Kong today.
I mean, that was Hong Kong in the 70s. It was a British colony. And I mean, the world is wildly different anyways from the 70s. But to go back to Hong Kong in the 21st century, and also as a mother and as an adult and as an expat, is wildly different from growing up in Hong Kong.
You start off your book with this great description of women going to Hong Kong as expatriates. And what is the expat scene like in Hong Kong?
I always want to make it clear that there are very, very many different kinds of expats. And my book is about a certain substrata of expatriates, which are mostly American and mm-hmm. mostly affluent. Mercy is a Korean-American girl in her 20s who moves to Hong Kong, and she's struggling to make it work. But the other two women are middle-aged women who have means and they live a certain lifestyle. So when people ask me what it's like, I always say it's very privileged. It's a bubble that you live in because mm-hmm. a lot of the time you get a housing allowance, you get help. And so your life is very different than what it would be in the U.S. And the biggest difference, I think, that people find is that you have more time because a lot of the menial, you know, everyday tasks that we have to do here to get by are sort of taken away from you and given to someone else. So mm-hmm. you just have a lot more time and there's more leisure.
And a lot more time to devote to motherhood.
Well, there's a lot more time to do whatever you'd like. Imagine if you didn't have to do the laundry or, you know, make the beds or clean the house. You would have a lot more time if you were a stay-at-home mom. A lot of people take that time, and a lot of women I knew started businesses. A lot of people decided to do what they had always wanted to do, which was paint. So people took very many different paths. When I moved to Hong Kong, I joined a baby group and a book club, and they were extraordinarily accomplished women, most of whom had gone to Harvard Business School, and half of them were working very intensive jobs, which required a lot of travel, and half of them weren't. But everyone sort of got together, and we were all connected by this fact that we had help and we had time, and everyone chose what they were going to do with that time.
Tell us a little bit about the three expats characters, the main characters in this book. You mentioned Mercy, who's a young Korean-American woman.
Right.
What's her story?
She believes that she's been dogged by bad luck because of her fortune or something that a fortune teller told her mother when she was younger. She's very clever and went to Columbia, but she's never quite made it work. And so she goes to Hong Kong to see if she can make a new start. And then, of course, something terrible happens. She meets another woman, Margaret, who has three children, who's sort of a typical trailing spouse expat, whose husband has a job that brought their family there. And then on a whim, Margaret hires Mercy to be their nanny. And then she loses one of her children while they're on a trip. So they're connected in that way. And then another woman is Hillary, who is part of a childless couple in Hong Kong. They've been trying to have children. They've been expats for around eight years, I think. And their lives intersect in a way that you don't see coming for a little bit.
And did one of the characters come to you first?
Hillary is that woman who was the woman that started the whole book. She was this woman lying in bed. She didn't want to get up. She had a dinner party. She needed to get up. And it's funny to me that she would start the book because, you know, the way the book is now, Mercy and Margaret are the beginning of the book and sort of the crux of the whole story. But that's how stories emerge for me. They're very instinctual, and I go back and I just work on them until they feel right. But that involves a lot of rewriting, and it usually takes around 5 years.
You mentioned that the expatriates that you write about in this novel are not representative of all expats because, of course, there are the missionaries and there are, you know, people coming from other countries and people who are doing that menial labor. But you do call the book The Expatriates. Was there something that you wanted to capture about the expat experience in the stories of these women?
I think that the term expatriate can seem quite glamorous and people view it as, oh, you're going to live in another country and then you get to be someone who's not yourself for a limited period of time and come back. So I just thought I like the term expatriate because it just confers a certain aura around that experience. I always compare being an expat to going to college. You are there for a limited time and that really informs your experience. You know, and in that way, it can be very intense because you know you're there for a limited period of time.
And it's a bubble, right?
Yeah,
it's
and you form very intense bonds with the people. I mean, you become very, very good friends with the people that you're there with. And it's very formative because you're older, but you're doing things for the first time. You don't know how to get a driver's license. You don't know how to do a lot of things. And you're there with your year, I like to say. You become friends with people who arrive the same time you do a lot of the time because you're on that same learning curve. It's just a very intense and bonding experience.
What's it like coming back to New York after those 10 years? Nobody bonds here.
Everyone's so busy. I feel
we're too busy to bond.
In Hong Kong, it was really remarkable because you could really call up anyone and be like, do you want to have dinner? Or, you know, let's meet for a drink. Or you could have 3 or 4 or 10 people show up just because we had so much more time. And I used to think my friends who are New Yorkers, they were so busy and they never had time to see me. They said, oh, maybe I'll see you for a coffee at 10:15 to 10:45. And I thought they were crazy. And now I've become that person. I have no time.
Yeah, you're just as crazy.
I know.
Did you think about the legacy of novels about Americans abroad? Obviously, there's Henry James and there's just a whole tradition of that. Were you conscious of that while writing your book, of sort of being part of that?
I'm such a subconscious / unconscious writer, but I've read so much, and I particularly love novels of colonial India. So I think that informs your writing very subconsciously, but I wasn't trying to channel anyone in particular.
You mentioned that the character came to you before the place, but did you know that the character was going to be outside of the U.S. or not?
I had no, I thought she might be in New York.
So for your next novel, do you have a character or place at this point?
Right now, I'm just working on a short story, and it's about 3 couples having dinner at a dinner party in the suburbs. And I don't know where those suburbs are, but I think it's in America.
Somewhere where they have time to do those things, not New York.
Right, exactly.
All right, Janice, thank you so much.
Thanks, Pamela.
The book, again, is The Expatriates, the new novel by Janice Y.K. Lee, whose previous novel was The Piano Teacher. Greg Coles joins us now with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list? We have movement at last?
We have movement at last. There are at least a couple of new things on the list. They're both on the hardcover fiction list. Starting down at number 11, Chris Bojalian returns to the list with his new novel, The Guest Room. This is about a suburban husband whose wife takes their daughter out of town so that he can throw a wild bachelor party for his brother, and it gets a little wilder than anybody expected, and things kind of spin out of control. So that's new at number 11. And then the second new title is all the way at the top of the list. That is The Force Awakens, the movie novelization by Alan Dean Foster. It's not actually the first novelization of The Force Awakens to hit the list. There's been a junior novelization kicking around the middle grade hardcover list. That's at number 2 in its third week. And there have been various other iterations or tie-ins of this new Star Wars movie. But this is the first one to hit the adult list. And what's interesting about it is since Disney basically, in taking this franchise over from George Lucas, The Force Awakens essentially is an updating and retelling of the original Star Wars movie, New Hope. Alan Dean Foster is the same author that George Lucas turned to back in 1976 to ghostwrite the very first novelization of the Star Wars movies. So Disney not only remaking the first movie, also remaking the first novelization by turning to him.
My favorite Star Wars adaptation story recently was that Star Wars may have turned into a musical at one point, apparently,
really?
With Jason Robert Brown, the great Jason Robert Brown, to write the music. Yeah.
A galaxy far, far away.
Maybe coming to Broadway one of these days soon. And this week marks a year on the list for The Girl on the Train.
It does. It's at number two, where it has been for quite some time. And yes, it's 1 year old, 52 weeks on the list. On the nonfiction side, there's nothing new, but I did want to quickly point out that Atul Gawande's Being Mortal has returned to the list after falling off for a few weeks, and it's returned all the way at number four, which again suggests maybe there was a big Christmas push for that one.
It's always what you want to give someone for Christmas, a little yeah. bit of death.
He told me once that he thought the book wouldn't sell well at all, partly because it was supposed to come out in the summer or fall, and instead he delayed and delayed, and it finally came out right at the holidays, and he thought, oh, no one's going to want to buy it for the holidays. And he's been proven wrong.
And I expect death will return to the list again next week when I imagine Paul Kalanithi's book, When Breath Becomes Air, hits the list.
Yeah, that's a book that's getting a lot of attention. Paul Kalanithi, of course, the doctor who died young, I think he was 36, of cancer, and kept notes and turned it into this book. He died before it came out. But yeah, it's getting a lot of attention. It does look like a likely contender to be on the list next week.
All right. We'll see if we are proven correct. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.